But as you all realize, this is Seminary Week, and we've been celebrating and commemorating various historical facts and figures, and yet I can't really knock the historical aspects much either, because this is important. So, well, the real purpose today is to consider our present training and how we think it does or does not relate to our future ministry. And finding or seeking a sounding board for this, I think that we can turn to the keynote address of this whole week, which was given by David Schuller on Sunday afternoon, in which he spoke of theological education in crisis and renewal, and realizing that not very many of us students, at least, were at this convocation, we're going to begin by allowing Mr. Bill Bursley to give us a brief synopsis of what exactly David Schuller said at that time. I might just introduce the other members of the panel here while we're at it. On my left is Mr. Ron Seaman, Mr. Herbert Mayer, Mr. John Werfel, Donald Defner, Bill Bursley, Walt Button. I'm Jim Weeble. And after Bill gets done with his synopsis, we'll leave it open very briefly to the panel if they'd like to comment or reflect on some of their own reactions to this address by Mr. Schuller. And then we're going to open it up to dialogue. And I'll try to field the questions as best I can. And we don't expect to have all the answers to any of the questions or comments or reflections that you might bring up at this time, but at least we'll be able to get some of our own personal reactions or reflections to these. So with that said, Bill, you're up.
By necessity, the eloquence of Dr. Stewart's articulation will suffer in the meaning of my summary. In this address, entitled Theological Education, Crisis, and Renewal, Dr. Stewart begins with the now familiar and alluded to observation this morning from the chapter that all Americans choose theological institutions. Are favored profound and rapid change, and are consequently caught in the words of John Gardner, whom Dr. Stewart quotes. Quote, in a savage crossfire between uncritical lovers and loving critics. Desiring to be neither an uncritical lover nor an unloving critic, Dr. Stewart urges rather that we, as students and administration and faculty, take realistically but hopefully through crisis. Theological education. We are first the crisis of faith, second the crisis of context, and thirdly the crisis of institution. In his discussion of the crisis of faith, Dr. Schuller contends that the reality of radical secularity that has come to be synonymous with our culture has asked with a critical intensity whether God and the existence of that thing or reality fits at all in the world come of age, and cites Bonhoeffer in this respect. So says Dr. Schuller, man has entered spiritual life age, filled with a rigid grasp created by the vacancy of God. He contends that this question is the primary root question because, quote, behind the questions of the mission of the church, behind technical discussions of how one interprets scripture, behind concern with structure, behind the agonizing of clergy about their roles in the modern world lies the theological question in its most blunt, crass form. This has many impacts on the theological enterprise. Many students enroll with no clear conviction about the gospel, students for whom the question of whether one can yet confess I believe in God has not even been answered. He calls these students searchers. Teachers not so much after professional skill as after life, truth, God, wholeness. Questions who are entwined in all that we connote by that rather hackneyed phrase, identity crisis. The presence of such students on a theological seminary campus creates problems. It generates a greater dilemma, a crisis of role or identity for the seminary itself, because they find themselves, the seminary finds itself, hard pressed to define whether they are to meet therapeutic community seeking to answer questions of personal identity, or whether they are professional centers of training designed to prepare already committed for the task of ministry. On analogy to a medical school, which doesn't act as a hospital for medical students, but rather intends to train them in the healing arts, Stuart affirms that theological seminaries should be more concerned with the task of professional preparation. We'll return to this in just a moment. The second crisis is the crisis of context, which deals with the way in which seminaries are and should be related to the university, the world, and the church. Hershey maintains that theological education can no longer afford to be divorced from the university setting. Quote, to train men who would minister in today's world, we need students who've been fashioned in the rough and tumble of a rising educational marketplace, not contacting divergent strains of thought through the faith filter of a denominational teacher interpreting another's ideas, but only through first-hand contact with bones. Some of the values for a universe of the university setting are, one, contact with graduate professionals who are on the frontiers of research in all kinds of disciplines. Second, presence in the midst of a community which has and does set high standards of excellence that are much in demand for seminary education. Third, an opportunity to dialogue with other disciplines. And fourthly, access to the resources of large research libraries, scholars of the highest endowment, and the rich offerings of busy lecturers and performing artists. We would note that Dr. Stuart warned that day that such a love affair between the university and the denominational seminary is not necessarily mutual. Great universities often place the presence of confessional commitment in their midst with a reduction in intellectual honesty. The crisis of context is also a crisis in the theological seminary and seminarians' relationship in the world. Awareness, as I think we all realize, of the complexity of society is essential to ministry. Such ministry demands leadership that moves beyond the technical grasp of religion. It demands, quote, an essential understanding of the modern world. It demands that a man personally learns to live as a man in it. The average seminarian has probably not encountered the world in all its beauty and brutality, which is a quoted then. Now, the average seminarian has probably not encountered the world in all its beauty and brutality because, says Dr. Stuart, three cocoons in faithful. The cocoon of family relationships and financial dependency, the web of academia, and the church itself. He notes in this regard that fieldwork and internships were originally initiated as a path into the world. But the changing concept of the nature of ministry and an awareness of the variety of ministry have even called these patterns into question. He does offer some solutions to this crisis of cocoonery, if I can coin the phrase. One is the concept of field education, which offers a maximum exposure to both poles, to the world and the academic. The other, a much more dramatic proposal, is that only those men, and listen closely, it's only those men who have lived, labored, loved in the world, struggled, and somehow passed through a cross of identity crisis should begin their education as a ministry. It was felt among the members of the panel in the discussion we had yesterday that the drama of this proposal should be better portrayed if we would be better portrayed if we let Dr. Stuart speak for himself at this point. In context, a more dramatic solution is being proposed. Let the seminary focus sharply on professional theological education. Let it demand that its students face their fundamental questions of personal prior to enrollment. Rather than denying the validity of the existential struggle, it takes it with utmost seriousness and suggests that the place to answer these questions is not in a theological or academic context, but in the midst of contemporary society. I sincerely believe that a person first must come to grips with himself as a man before he defines his role as a clergyman, or he will spend his lifetime using his role to answer his own personal needs. Thus, a year or more of involvement in any of the significant contemporary struggles currently taking place might well become a prerequisite for enrollment in schools that propose to sharpen the knowledge and skills of men who have already proved themselves in areas other than the writing and term basis. Ideally, a man would be engaged in an area where people are bent on social change. Imagine a school composed of men who already possess a personal knowledge of people in modern society, who understand personally the deepest needs and aspirations, the glories and follies of that world, who are now asking the professional question of how the gospel speaks to those realities. The resulting quality of life would be less simple and less defensive. There would be no fussing about such questions as daily quizzes on the part of faculty or students. Academic gamesmanship to find God, a new sense of quest to take its place. There would not be a reduction in the battle of ideas. Hopefully, there would be a reduction of intellectual debate as an end in itself. Thus, a school could insist upon the validity of the academic enterprise without setting it in opposition to action in the world. Theology could be studied with new vigor because of the added maturity and social realism carried by the students. A new generation of professors, those trained in teachers and professionals, will need to be developed. While they will possess graduate training, their model will not be university graduate departments. Their ultimate focus will be upon the practice of ministry. They too will be men who have known the struggle of social involvement, who are skilled in applying their own particular disciplines of theology to the great human problems of given periods. As the Baptist. Finally, the third crisis of context is the crisis of church, both denominational and the broader Christian community. Dr. Schuller notes that while Concordia Seminary and its relationship to its denomination has a strongly centralized pattern of ministerial education in this seminary, and has the highest proportion of denominational financial support of any other seminary from the continent, it nevertheless must bear the onus of some of the lowest salaries for faculty and administration among all accredited theological schools in the country. And, quote, it struggles under the most cumbersome system of external non-faculty control, end quote. Finally, the crisis of context is also a crisis in the relationship of the seminary to the broader Christian community. Here, Dr. Schuller talks about seminary clusters. These clusters, he says, are the same future. Within the next decade in North America, large-scale cooperative efforts will begin among confession-based seminaries as they gather around large and private and public universities in urban centers to share symbiotic financial, theological, and intellectual resources. And only in such a way will the denominational seminary be able to resolve the third crisis, the crisis of institutions, which dwindles their substance and their rather restricting and enervating parochial denominational endeavors. As a point of information, Dr. Steele pointed out that three such clusters are already in existence, one at Berkeley, one at Boston, and one at Dubuque. Thank you. Y Coach, which now offers some 1,500 students a choice of 775 monthly listed courses taught by a faculty of 250, including ranking scholars from Harvard, Boston, and MIT. And beyond the mere academics, there is also the fact that in clusters, quote, one comes to see himself as a Lutheran person most clearly that he has had to define both in unity with and his differences from a Baptist, Dominican, Presbyterian, and Episcopalian. One welcomes the richness and diversity that our historic differences represent and seeks to discover how they can be useful to minister in a pluralistic setting. In the midst of crises, Dr. Shuler closed with the affirmation and the hope that the potential of the Spirit will empower our spirit with courage and conviction for renewal.
Presented. And this is what the whole purpose of this is, to get a little response now on the parts, first of all, the panel, if they have them to offer, and then I'll open it up to the rest of us here.
I'll take a chance to start out. I think one of the key foci upon which we could center our attention here would be this tension between the training for a professional ministry, and on the other hand, the asking of these existential questions. Now, I would hope that all of my colleagues, and I have this subliminally and concomitantly in mind as I'm teaching for a task and learning of certain data, training for certain skills, know that the person who isn't certain of his own faith right now, I hope, is learning something of certainty as we say, how could I reach this college freshman, and so on. Yet I wonder if the primary task of our school isn't the training for the professional task. And zeroing in with Dr. Mayer's comment here, that we do have a God who does give us, if we use the means of grace, the certainty, the knowledge, the conviction, that we can know who we are and where we are going in his kingdom. And that we have due sympathy and love and respect for the man for whom his pure Christianity is still in question. But we would hope that that using of the means of grace which God gives us could soon bring that man to the certainty of his Christianity. And then we can more quickly get at the professional task of training for a specific ministry.
Let me respond then, from taking off the same point, from my brief experience here, 6 to 7 weeks, one thing I've noted in all of the conversations that have gone on here is this very thing that Shuler was pointing to. Namely, that I found a lot of students here asking these existential questions, questions about meaning for their own lives, the God-type questions. And this kind of came as a conflict to me because I was asking different types of questions, probably the more professional. And so if I may just kind of personally respond to this, I just really grabbed me what Dr. Shuler had to say, because this seems to me, as I was looking at the situation in which I find myself, to well define what I see the problem this place to be, at least as far as my education is attempting to move on. Namely, that I find myself not able to move as far as I want to, because too often, both in classroom situations and in just interpersonal situations, I have found myself running into the problems of, you know, fellows asking the God, is God question. And you know, I'm trying to operate in a different kind of context. So just personally, you know, this becomes very meaningful to me, that I have not been able to find a niche in this community for myself yet, because I haven't found the type of questions being asked that I would like to discuss. Now, I don't know whether we can, you know, completely separate the two areas, but something has to be different at this place for me to carry out my for educational.
I wasn't going to speak, but I think I will. I've been here about as many years as you have been weeks, which isn't very long. I got hung up on that analogy between a medical school and a seminary in the seats, and I didn't listen to anything further on Sunday, because I found myself so deeply involved in that analogy and questioning where it had gone wrong. Because in my experience with myself and with my students, it is simply wrong. A school in which we no longer need to pray publicly in chapel for those who have problems with their vocation. And underlying that prayer is surely questions about themselves. It's not the seminary I know. It's not myself. A chapel exercise, to use a terrible phrase, a chapel service is not like an operation in a medical arena. We are not observing, we are involved. We were addressed this morning in the chapel service in the vitals of our being, and were challenged by every word whether we could commit ourselves to that. I think maybe I've said enough. I think the dilemma is very deep, and I think the solution suggested by this paper is unreal.
As a number of you have very pointedly observed, I've already had my track this morning. But there's another dimension that it seems to me we're losing, and Lutherans of all people should not be losing, and that is this myth of perfectionism. This myth that somewhere, somehow, someday, we're all going to reach the state of absolute, total joy in commitment. That somehow we're going to divorce the justus et peccator thing in favor only of the justus. Part of our problem, I suspect, is our fear of doubt and our inability to live with it. And as one who had gone through a rather lengthy and critical period of radical unbelief, I'm not really bothered by doubt. You can live with it very nicely. You can live with unbelief rather comfortably. Maybe we magnify doubt into too much of a, more of a ghost and a specter than it really is.
Okay.
Well, I
two sentences of Schuller's, there would not be a reduction in the battle of ideas later, but the ultimate focus would be upon the practice of the ministry.
Dr. Bartlett reacted to. It may not have come out exactly what I wanted to say. Let me try to restate it. I have found some men here asking the question about, let's just take this as, is God, does God exist? This type of question. And my comment, and the reason I said, Schuller speaks to me, is because I can't speak to that guy with the means of grace if he's asking me. Does God exist? Because he's asking that question, that's a prior question, you have to ask that one before you can say, well, God will speak to me, through his word or through his sacrament. So if you're asking that question, you're not even putting yourself in a position to say, to let God speak to you. If you're asking the question whether he speaks at all, how can you hear him? So that was kind of the direction I was taking to my comment.
You want to respond? Not directly. This business of speakers coming to seminaries. I think perhaps where we've been just a little bit is that in our system, we've never really admitted to ourselves the possibility of that radical assertion. And you boys have been too protected, and so have I. But the very question is so terribly threatening. It's down before it's even asked. What I found very valuable, and it's a little buried in the paper, and it came out even more clearly, Bill, in your resume, is that probably some place there ought to be a buffer between the initial training and the seminary, a buffer in which we're sent out into the world really to get involved with life that it's worth. The fight with ourselves out there first, and then come in here and fight in the continuum.
May I write there? This is excellent. I sincerely believe that a person first must come to grips with himself as a man before he defines his role as a clergyman, or he will spend his lifetime using his role to answer his own personal needs.
Thank you.
I'd like to respond to what Richard Kennedy, you said before. When we look back, I've been in the system since high school. And when I look back over all the years, I often start seeing the fellas that I don't see around anymore. And a lot of times I thought those guys would have made a lot better pastor than I'm going to make. And this has been very disturbing to me, the students that we lose. And why do we lose them? And I think what Richard or Dick Kennedy said before, part of the reason we don't really have a community on campus that we think we have.
To his very last comment, Schuller defined where he does define. He doesn't define it well enough, I don't think. But in his paper, when talking about the professional aspect, I think perhaps we're not really saying what he's saying. He defines it here as the professional question being, how does the gospel speak to these realities? Meaning, you know, anything that you encounter. And I think this would go right along with what Dick was talking too. He sees the professional task not as, you know, getting a handbook for practical ministry. He sees the professional question being, say, okay, now how does the gospel start speaking to the situation we have right here, or the situation I'm going to face when I get into the parish. So it's not just, you know, I don't want us to think that Schuller is saying that, you know, we get all the answers in our book or something like that and shine the skills. This is a professional task. He's talking about the realities of the gospel speaking to the realities of life.
Perhaps there's something else we need to keep distinct in our own thinking, too. I'm still very sympathetic to what Defner opened the session with, and that is the dimension of spiritual formation which George Hoyer has been doing so much in. There is a difference between ongoing spiritual formation and the existential question that Ron is talking about. We're not assuming, nor are we still assuming, that we now get the perfect man. As a first-year man, and we pay no attention to him as an individual any longer. He has no individual needs any longer. We just feed stuff into him. We're still concerned primarily with the formation of a man in Christ, with the provision of enough resources that at least for the first year he can apply the gospel to his problem. There's nothing automatic or mechanical about our understanding of Schuller.
Not being
treasure in what you've found. Offhand, I don't think we feel it in the day-to-day teaching test. I think we might feel it very critically if we attempt to make radical changes.
Sending them to a foreign vicarage. the basic problem is there, the problem of culture that you're going to have to deal with, that you're going to solve by your victory. And therefore, I believe that from one viewpoint, and I suppose this is true in the various problems that you have, whether you're going to have a state contribution in the city, whether you're going to have an inner city problem, or whether you're going to have a suburban problem. The other thing is the overestimation of the vicarage and experience. It seems to me that at a certain stage of life, you will have a certain series of experiences, but if the Heraclitus who warns that you can't even cross the same stream the same twice, because not only does the stream change, but you change. And there's something that hits you between the ages of 24 and 30, which may not, some things which don't get you then, which will get you when you're older. And therefore, it seems that some way or other, we are rubbing our elbows with the rest of society, and this thing under God, and I hope this is just a pious thought, under God, these things are going to be affected later in whatever place we find ourselves. This might sound like a bit of an apologia pro vita sua, since I have alcoholia directly from the seminary, and so practically nothing about what's happening here.
Let me begin with the request to Dr. Wegner that you invite no visiting prof for next year. It's a whole lot more comfortable when these two guys aren't here. And I will follow that then with a very simple observation, which Ed, in my poor mind, does justice to what you said, does justice to what Herb says, does justice to what Dick Kennedy talks about. And that is that our primary business is the formation of men in Christ. And our primary resources are the means of grace. And I would suggest, following Ron's lead here, that we put into a completely separate category those poor devils who are asking the basic question about whether God exists.
I wonder if they're poor devils.
I'd like to offer just an observation. You see, part of it, my head is right. And in my capacity, I've been dealing with a lot of people I've had identity crisis. We usually identify identity crisis as the adolescent period of life. But people really have identity crisis, and they're really searching for who they are and what they are. And it could be that somebody gets the point when he says, maybe this is part of the system. And it isn't only our system, but it is our entire society. We specialize in teaching people adolescence for long periods of time, with our increased emphasis on more and more and more schooling. And therefore, more and more and more dependency. And this, I think, is an impact that we should bear in mind. Personally, I don't think the identity crisis is so bad. The passage suggests that in our institutions, too, we ought to increase the scope of our counseling. And I don't even know the practical department of teaching our counseling. But to have people available, perhaps in greater numbers, to whom people could really go to talk about them. This might be an idea that we should pursue. I personally appreciate Dr. Stewart's paper very much, and I felt that at this particular point, we just don't have to really think about it. But I'm just writing, well, one other thing I want to add there. Every one of us goes through life with a few pockets of immaturity left in between there. I don't care how old you are, and you think you even are quite old, maybe yourself. And all the young sons on the new place of this day, so an immature attitude. And I don't know if we can ever rid ourselves entirely of the serious jewels that we call the attitude to learn. And I just want to talk this off to what might be worth as an insight to the problem. I'm grateful for this. question is, how do I think about the system of adequate preservation? I think basically we've got to operate with two problems. Number one, once you have a man, a full man, you can get to an end. The first question is, do you really want to have a man? The fact that I have conscience as a student, the fact that I have doubt today about whether Luther really teaches the basis of an assessment or not, these doubts in the natural Western method can become the most powerful opposition to indigenous materialism and thus become the assessment. Therefore, I would hesitate to say that faith can be that kind of soul itself. Secondly, if we want to get people over the extent of Christ or Christ or faith or psychological identity, Christ or whatever the name of Jesus or Christ is, the question is how are we going to do it? Are we going to throw a person with this kind of pirate into the prison that is so coming? It might be the solution for one person, it might be used for another. Or are we going to use counsel as well? Because I believe this is part of our problem here. That he took the natural on the death of our state, but that this state would have stayed up there because he had come to the present. In other words, I'm proposing the fact that we only one who has only two of the natural that is at all the wrong. And lastly, suppose we do not want to do this problem. How are we going to eliminate the problem? Why? Both by culture, or by consciousness, or by law. And where is the difference? This is one of the most important questions. I may be allowed to be lucky if one can make a good life to the world.
Well, this is the thought.
answer to Professor Schrader's question. How do you get this mutual consolation of the brethren? It doesn't just happen unless if I do it. I wish that I were grabbed by the arm into more cheering groups around here. I don't know how many there are. I think this is one of the biggest things happening in the last few years. I wish I were still, as I was a couple of years ago, a prof assigned to X dorm. And I would come over, leaving my wife alone with the news, and be there during those 20 minutes at 10 o'clock at night. I struggle myself sitting in this hall with a man whose personality is different than mine, but I come regardless of his age or his discipline, regardless of his always preaching in a text from his area of exegesis or whatever, and I say, what can God say to me through this man? I'm trying still, after 21 years in the ministry, to accept and to learn the difference of gifts and how God can speak to me so differently through such different men. An older man in the classroom, I, as a student, would have thought years ago, what can he tell me? And when I went out in the ministry, I sat at the feet of old geezers and listened to them talk for hours and learned far more than I did from some fireball. I guess I'm speaking of a habitus by which I still, even now in the ministry, am a learner. And I'm saying, how can God speak to me through that man? Here in the pulpit or there in the classroom?
One more? Okay, we'll take one more. Okay, I see that our time is just about drawn to a close. I'd just like to offer one comment here. This pamphlet, this is Schuller's address in toto, is going to be made available to everybody here, I understand. And so you might be expecting that sometime in the near future. I don't know how to close this. I just want to react just to one comment I heard over here. The idea of bringing in a bigger pastoral staff and something like this. What I think has come out here today, and which I think we all realize, is that here among ourselves, we have the biggest resource of counselors that we could ever expect to have. And so I guess the only thing that I can say now is, man, let us reason with one another. And this is it. Thank you.